This is a podcast from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Health and Living with me, T. Shao Ik, and my co-host for this Friday Doctor in the House segment, Dr. George Lee, consultant urologist. How are you, George?
Oh, Shao Ik, I tell you, earlier on, I was so depressed. I came in, it was torrential atrocity out there, gridlock everything. But now, suddenly, when we're about to start our show with our great personality who's about to go on air, the sun is shining. Mm-hmm. I'm sure the traffic is all flowing really well now. You know, Prof Yip, we're really looking forward to the show with you.
And yes, that's who we're talking to today, Professor Emeritus Dato Dr. Yip Ching Ha. She's a consultant breast surgeon. I mean, if you talk about breast surgery, that's the name that you think of. She's also been recently elected the first woman president of the International Society of Surgery. And this international society represents over 3,000 surgeons across the globe. Such a milestone, I think, for a Malaysian woman to be heading this organization. So we're going to catch up with Dr. Yip, find out about sort of her work over the years in breast cancer, both as a clinician, as a surgeon, as well as a researcher. And what are her goals to make surgical care universally accessible in Malaysia? If you have questions, you can call us at 03-7733-2900. You can also WhatsApp us 01-8789-8899. Prof Yip, how are you today? Thank you so much for being with us.
Good. Can you hear me?
Yes, loud and clear.
Okay. I am actually in my clinic. I'm not actually in the studio. So I'm so sorry, George, I cannot see you.
It's okay. Just have your aura and that halo that we can see on Zoom is enough for me.
You can get my aura.
Yeah. And congratulations. I'm sure many listeners out there who's been touched and whose life been changed by the great surgeon yourself, I'm sure they're all happy and also join me in congratulating you.
Thank you very much. Any questions? I know George very well, just to let you know. George was in the Department of Surgery with me together. Remember George?
That's right. I know. I left
sure
about
two. If you have embarrassing stories to share of George, please do.
I'm sure later on that will emerge. But what I am really, really surprised is that, Prof Yip, you know, for most of us after, you know, we retire from government service and then, you know, we kind of like cut down on our services, focus more on the work-life balance, but you're going from strength to strength. And now the president of International Society of Surgery. Wow. It's like, what keeps you going? And are you ever going to stop?
Probably. Maybe I will stop after maybe about 4 years. I think I'm giving myself 4 to 5 years more. And then I'm going to really retire. You know? I retired once already, so I have to retire again.
I think you'll be bored, Prof Yip, if you actually do retire. But let's talk a little bit about the society. You know, for the benefit of those who aren't familiar with it, what does the International Society of Surgery do?
Okay, now the International Society of Surgery, okay, was founded in Brussels in 1902 by two Belgian surgeons as a forum for surgeons around the world to share techniques and outcomes of new surgical procedures. Currently, there are around 3,000 members from all over the world, and the mission of the society is to work for international teaching in surgery, both specialized and general surgery in developed and developing countries. And the International Surgical Society is actually made up of 6 integrated societies, of which Breast Surgery International is one of them. So actually, I was president of Breast Surgery International a few years ago, for about 2 years. And the Breast Surgery International had an MOU with the Ministry of Health in Malaysia to actually run breast surgery workshops here. So that was going on very well until COVID strike. So we haven't actually got back into track yet because of COVID. So COVID actually put us in hibernation for about 2 to 3 years. Now, how many members do we have in Malaysia? Malaysia currently has about 40 members in ISS. And of note, Tan Sri Dr. Nor Hisham Abdullah, who is our Director General of Health, has just completed a 4-year term as a member of the Council of the International Society of Surgery. And now Professor April Roslani, who is also a very well-known woman colorectal surgeon, and she's professor of surgery in UM as well as the dean of the medical faculty, has just been appointed as a council member. So Malaysia has always got actually quite a long-term relationship with the International Society of Surgery. I was a member since like about 2005, so I've been a member for almost 20 years, you know. And in fact, if you look at it, Tan Sri, Dr. Nor Hisham was the one who actually recruited me as a member of ISS. He was a member before me. So I go back quite a long way, you know, with ISS, and I've been attending the ISS meetings, and it's one of those societies which is really one of the few, you know, isn't it, George, where you have an international group of surgeons. Mm-hmm. And it's been said that this is very good for networking, and those friends that we make among surgeons in ISS remain our friends forever. So indeed, it's always good, because I have friends who are surgeons from all over the world, even from as far as South Africa, you know.
So with so many illustrious Malaysians, you know, sitting at such high levels in the society, what does it mean for Malaysia, right? How can we use that networking, this platform or knowledge sharing to improve the profession in Malaysia?
Well, you know, Malaysia is going to host the next International Surgical Week, because the International Society of Surgery runs a big conference every 2 years. So we just had one in Vienna. So the next one in Malaysia is going to be in KLCC, and that's going to be a big meeting. And we've got a lot of Malaysians involved in this, you know? So, I mean, it's good for Malaysia to run an international conference, which is going to attract surgeons from all over the world. And we hope to have about 2,000 surgeons at this meeting.
Mm-hmm. Prof Yip, obviously, shall we mention that, you know, to have a woman president, actually, you're the first person. I mean, I remember the days when we were in medical school, in order to get into a College of Surgeons exams, you can just walk into there, everyone's in suit and tie. There are usually a handful of women in there. And then obviously those days have changed from the time when we were doing fellowship exams. And of course, medical school proportions of female to male ratio has also changed. Because in my days, it's something like 20% women and then 80% men. I'm sure that's the other way around now. So can you tell us a little bit about the challenges this journey has been for women surgeons and also doctors in general?
Actually, I do not really believe in being gender specific. I'm a surgeon first and a woman next. You know what I mean? Because I don't want to be known as a woman surgeon, you know, because some men hate it, you know, George. You know, I have some men who say, what's so special about you? Just because you're a woman, people say that, you know, it's great that you're a woman. I mean, I would prefer to be known as the president of the International Society of Surgery and not really as the first woman to be present. As you know, I was the first woman to be head of surgery in the Department of Surgery in UM. Did you feel it when you were there? I think I was head of surgery when you came.
Indeed, that's right.
Did you feel funny having a woman head of surgery? Because I think like a man, because I was always the only woman among men. So yeah, if I were to tell the men that I'm a woman, you must treat me different. Mm-hmm. I don't think they are going to be very happy with that, isn't it? Mm. You know? So I was training at the time, but there was no thing such as sexual harassment. I'm sure I was sexually harassed throughout, but in those days, they call it teasing.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
There's a fine line between teasing and sexual harassment.
But what I'm trying to allude to is that the opportunities, because, I mean, medicine and also surgery in particular, it always has been perceived as kind of like old boys club. And then all these positions are reserved for your pals. And also women are perceived to be not really able to carry on with that sort of like strenuous, robust lifestyle and then on-calls and that sort of thing. Clearly, you proved them wrong. But can you kind of like elaborate a little bit about the challenges you face yourself and also potential challenges people might face for new medical students who really aspire to follow your footstep?
Well, actually, the role of women in Asia is that we are the one at home looking after the children, doing the cooking and everything like that. So First of all, we have to actually overturn that thing that women's work is in the house. Okay. When I told my friends that I wanted to be a surgeon, the first thing they told me was that you will never get married. So the perception is that if you want to do surgery, because it's a strenuous job, you're always on calls, it's going to be very hard for you to find a husband. It's going to be very hard for you to have children. And I think it is wrong because we have so much support at home nowadays. You know, in Malaysia now, the last time we checked, 12% of surgeons are women. Mm-hmm. When I started training, I don't think it was even 1%. You know, there were only like, I think, 5 surgeons who were women in the whole country. And that included all the specialties of surgery. So I think the world is changing now.
Okay. But it's still only 12% versus 80%.
Shouldn't it be 50%?
Or even more, because
but it's much better than 1%, isn't it? You know, in US now, it's about 40% of the surgeons are actually women.
So how do we equalize that disparity? How do we equalize that? Clearly, there's still some disparity.
As you say, you know, more than 50% of the medical students are women. So a lot more women are going to take up surgery because there are more women, you know. So you will find that the percentage should increase. And in fact, right now, if you look at the surgical trainees, I think it's about 20-30% are actually women. Mm-hmm. So eventually we will actually have more women surgeons in the country.
Clearly, you sail through. I mean, you've got a supportive husband and also family. Your children obviously turn out extremely well. And what sort of tips would you give somebody who are about to embark on a surgical career and anticipating all these challenges of perhaps discriminations and also that responsibility and obligation to stay at home and then look after the kids and then juggle the work-life balance?
I would say that you have to pick your husband well. Because I know a lot of women who have given up surgery because the husband just didn't support them, you know. Because support at home is so important. Because after I got married, I stayed with my in-laws. It helped a lot because my in-laws have to look after my children. Okay, so a supportive husband, a supportive family, a supportive in-law, supportive parents, all these actually help a lot. Now, what if we don't have a supportive family? What are we going to do? The only thing is maybe don't get married. Then you can concentrate solely on your career.
But that then perpetuates the myth that if you as a woman wants to be a surgeon, you won't be able to get married, right? So I think you're right, Prof. Yip, that the attitude needs to change.
Attitude needs to change. The barriers to being a woman surgeon is actually internal. It's the woman herself, you know. We always say that this is not an external forces, it's internal forces. A woman who is determined will be a surgeon despite all the barriers, you know. I was quite ready to be single and not have children when I started my training, since everybody told me I won't get married. But fortunately, I found a man who, he's not a doctor. If he's a doctor, maybe he would be scared of, but he's not a doctor. So he didn't realize what the surgeon's life was. Because as a young lecturer, when we first got married, I was a young lecturer. 2-3 a.m., I would have to rush to the hospital. So much so that my father-in-law says, you better stay in the hospital. You know, it's not safe for you to go out in the middle of the night. So I spent my calls in the hospital rather than at home, even though I live very close to the hospital, you know.
I mean, really, what man or what partner wouldn't be proud to have, a surgeon as a spouse, right?
A man who is insecure.
True.
So maybe it's men who need to change their attitudes.
Both need to change. Women themselves need to believe that is doable, and men needs to continue to be proud of a very successful...
My husband is very proud of me. I mean, a lesser man would feel a little jealous, isn't it? Don't you think so?
Absolutely.
Mm. Absolutely, especially if you're in the same profession. That's why I always say that I'm glad he's not a doctor. If he's a doctor, we'll be competing.
All right. So if you are listening to Prof. Yip or you know of her achievements, I'm sure that will change your mind if you were one of those who thought that, oh, a woman can't be a surgeon or can't be a high-achieving medical professional. Prof. Yip is here to change your minds. We're speaking to Professor Emeritus Dato' Dr. Yip Ching Ha, consultant breast surgeon and newly elected president of the International Society of Surgery. I won't call her the woman president anymore because I know she doesn't like that. And together with my co-host, Dr. George Lee, we are speaking to Prof. Yip about this milestone, what she wants to achieve for the society. And we want to touch a little bit on accessibility of surgical care. What are the gaps here in Malaysia? Call us if you have questions or thoughts you'd like to share. 03-7733-2900. You can also WhatsApp 018-789-8899. We'll be right back. BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. Welcome back to Health and Living with me, T. Shao-Ik, and my co-host, Dr. George Lee, for this Friday afternoon Doctor in House segment. It's a pretty cloudy, very cold.
No longer raining.
No longer raining. You brought the sun out of the clouds, I think. George.
Prof. Yip did that. Because when I came in, it was too pouring.
It's a very, very cold Friday evening, though. We're speaking to Professor Emeritus Dr. Yip Ching Ha, consultant breast surgeon and president of the International Society of Surgery. She's given some insights into what the society does to, you know, improve and develop the profession of surgeons worldwide. Prof, any particular plans, your vision for the society during your tenure?
Well, you see, previous presidents have got different take on the what we should plan to do. Mm-hmm. So right now, I'm actually continuing what my previous predecessors have started, mm-hmm. and one of them is a global surgery, because the society, the International Society of Surgery, actually has a counselor in charge of global affairs, mm-hmm. and we are also one of the partners in the G4 Alliance. G4 Alliance is an advocacy group for global surgery. In 2015, the Lancet Commission of Global Surgery was published and highlighted the fact that 5 billion people worldwide do not have access to safe, affordable surgical and anesthesia care. Ah. They call it SOTA care, which is surgery, obstetrics, trauma, and anesthesia. And this is particularly in low and middle income countries, where 90% of the population cannot access basic surgical care. Surgical care means any surgery, particularly neglected surgical diseases, you know, simple things like the congenital disorders, particular cleft lip and cleft palate. When I was in school, you know, there were still a lot of children running around with unrepaired cleft lips and palates, which should be done when they are about 3 months old. Even now, I don't see it that often. So in Malaysia, we are actually a high middle income country. We are in a better position, you know. You know, when I was a young surgeon, I remember that surgeons had to do everything. I used to do pediatric surgery. Mm-hmm. And I actually even did a cleft palate and cleft lip.
Jack of all trade, right?
Yes, because we didn't have enough plastic surgeons. Malaysia is actually very well developed now surgically. I'm sure George knows, because now we had
all the toys.
I was training. We had no local surgical training program, and I sit for the fellowship exams in UK because that was our qualifying exam to be a surgeon, you know. So, and in those days, we were a surgeon in general. We do everything from pediatric surgery, neurosurgery, etc., because there were not enough surgeons. And we still lack surgeons in certain parts of Malaysia, particularly in East Malaysia. You know, so Malaysia still has some ways to go, because if you look at the Lancet Global Surgical Indicators, we have this thing called SAO ratio, surgical anesthesia obstetrician. It should be about 20 per 100,000 population. Mm-hmm. In Malaysia, the last time I actually did a study, I gave a lecture on it, we had about 14.5 100,000 population. So we still have some way to go, because we still are short of the ideal ratio. You must remember, in Malaysia, the surgeons all tend to congregate in the urban areas. So the rural areas are actually the rural patients actually have poor access to surgery. Okay, because and also majority of the surgeons are in private practice, not in the government service. So it looks like, you know, 60% of surgeons are in private sector, and the private sector treat only maybe about 40% of the surgical problems in the country. So there is a mismatch. So how do we solve this mismatch of surgeons, population, private surgeons, public surgeons? Well, we have to train more surgeons, that's it, and maybe try to keep them in government service. No, because in the university, I was also training surgeons. I teach surgeons. I teach the trainees surgery.
Mm-hmm. No?
Yeah.
But the number that we can train is limited by the number of trainers.
Mm-hmm.
So it's always a problem training enough surgeons for the whole country.
So do you have any plan during your tenure as the president? Is there any way that we can link in expertise from outside, channel in fundings? I know, obviously, one of the things that you have in the pipeline is this big conference, and that will enhance the networking and also bilateral collaborations. But do you have any plan that we can actually achieve the ideal of the ratio?
Well, I mean, ISS, we are talking global, sorry, not just Malaysia, we are talking global. So what ISS has done is actually to have associated societies in every country. So College of Surgeons, Academy of Malaysia, you know, we have a College of Surgeons in Malaysia. We are also associated with the International Surgical Society. And because we are associated with it, our surgeons who are members of the College of Surgeons actually pay a reduced rate. Because when you look at international societies, actually the subscription, the fees, the registration fees is actually quite expensive. So the ISS actually makes it cheaper for people in the low and middle income countries to join the society. We have stratified registration fees even for our conferences. So somebody from a low income country pays like maybe less than 50, more than 50% of what a person in a high-income country will pay, you know. So this is what ISS does to be able to get more surgeons from low- and middle-income countries, because our focus is actually to support surgeons in low- and middle-income countries. Globally, low- and middle-income countries, they tend to talk more about Africa, sub-Saharan Africa, because the need there is the most.
Mm-hmm.
The need in Malaysia is actually not as great as in sub-Saharan Africa.
Mm.
So that is what the focus is in most of the international groups. Like I say, the global surgery community, and in the US, there's a lot of global surgery departments, even in the universities there. So they actually have surgeons to go to Africa to do training, to run conferences and all that.
But nonetheless, in Malaysia, what are some basic issues where you can still see the disparities in access to surgical care? And, you know, what does it mean for patients in terms of health outcomes, quality of life, things like that?
Well, because like I say, Malaysia has developed very well. So now we have subspecialties. I mean, when I started training, there's no such thing called breast surgeon or colorectal surgeon or whatever. It was just a surgeon in general. So we are developing subspecialties so that patients, let's say, with a colon cancer can get access to a colorectal surgeon, because studies have shown that if you are treated in a specialized unit, the outcomes are better than if you're treated in a general surgical unit. You know, but of course, a competent general surgeon can actually do very good surgery as well. I mean, especially breasts, you know, breast surgeons are found only in certain pockets, you know, in Malaysia. So they've done a study. Actually, most breast surgeries are still being done by general surgeons, you know, because that's the thing about, Malaysia. We don't have enough really like super specialists. I mean, just to tell you a story, this was about 30 years ago. My aunt, who's from Ipoh, had a small head injury. She was conscious, loss of consciousness for a while. She was admitted for observation in a general hospital in Ipoh. They don't have a neurosurgeon then. They don't even have a CT scan. So while observing her, she became unconscious. Mm-hmm. And they say, oh, there must be a clot in the brain, you know. So they told the family to take her to a private hospital to do a CT scan. By the time she reached the private hospital, she died on the CT scanner. I mean, this would not have happened now, you know, if you have access to a CT scan and you have access to a neurosurgeon, you know, she probably would still be alive. So, and also there are many pockets in Malaysia where you don't have a neurosurgeon which could perform a life-saving operation.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, we used to train general surgeons to do the
burr hole.
But you don't have a CT scan. You don't know where your clot is. When I was a young surgeon, there was no CT scan in my hospital either. If somebody came with a head injury, we see which eye is dilated and we decided, oh, that the brain, the clot might be there, you know. So we just burr a hole here, burr a hole there.
That's terrifying.
So this is what was 30, 40 years ago. But now, of course, we have neurosurgeons, but again, there's no neurosurgeons in, let's say, rural Malaysia. I don't think there's a neurosurgeon in Kuantan, for example. So in those places, the general surgeon would have to do the neurosurgery.
That's not even rural, actually. Those are capital cities as well.
But, you know, some of the specialized services are just not there. Because I'm just taking neurosurgery as an example, because neurosurgery, if you have a head injury, you need to get to a neurosurgeon as fast as you can, you know. So if the neurosurgeon is like 4 hours away, then
absolutely
very likely you won't be able to get to a neurosurgeon on time.
Absolutely. So if we're talking about not only training more surgeons, but also the subspecialized surgeons.
Yes, the super specialists.
And even distribution of these surgeons.
Distribution, and like you said, there's a human resource problem there, Prof. Yip. You know, you need the senior surgeons to be able to train these younger ones. We have issues with specialization pathways.
Just keep on leaving for private practice, where you're going to find the trainers, you know?
So,
because in my department last time, I always tell George, but the lifespan of a surgeon in an academic unit is usually about 5 years, you know? Because it's so much more lucrative outside.
So what can we do about this attrition rate?
Well, the university tried by giving us private practice within public sector, but it was so limited that people still leave because it's not easy to do private and public together, you know. It's quite tiring. I did the private practice within the government service and, you know, you have to work at night. Nobody wants to work until 10 p.m. at night, you know, we have to have a life after office hours.
So, you know, under the ambit of an international society where you have that platform, do you think that, you know, that platform can push the agenda a little bit?
Yes. Because like I said, you know, I mean, for years, you know, the Breast Surgery International had an MOU with the Ministry of Health. Every year, we bring in surgeons from around the world to come to Malaysia.
Mm-hmm.
We have different sites and then we do a workshop on breast surgery one day, endocrine surgery one day. And that was really very good because it's a lot of networking.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, with all this international network, you can, you know, the local surgeons can actually find a placing, you know, to do training overseas. Like for me, I did most of my training in Malaysia, but breast surgery, I spent some time in UK just learning breast surgery. And that is from networking. I found a breast surgeon that, you know, because all this getting a placement or a job overseas is all who you know, you know.
Mm-hmm. Prof, I mean, one of the things that I always find quite challenging when it comes to surgery is the advancements of medical technology. Obviously, as you know, in urology, there are lots and lots of new toys, there are robots and everything. I'm sure in every single subspecialty, there's a lot of advancement like that. Will the International Surgical Society address that issues? Obviously, the access to such healthcare in the cutting edge technology is quite different between a country in the developed nation and emerging nations. And then how do we equalize that access to cutting edge technology in surgery?
Well, the ISS do training, like our job is education and training, but the training has to be in the country. The country has to be able to afford to buy a robot. Who can buy a robot? The Da Vinci system is what, about 12 million or something?
Mm-hmm.
Somewhere around there, you know? So it's not just buying the Da Vinci. You have to train people to use it. Training is not a problem, but the money to buy it is the problem.
So what I'm trying to allude to is that as a society, do you have access to other stakeholders such as the pharma companies, the technology developers, or even the corporations in order to see how this access to new technology can be a bit of more level playing field?
Yeah, I mean, this is also what we do in the International Surgical Week. That's when we bring all these new companies, you know, to come in, you know, to display their technology and hopefully, you know, introduce this technology to surgeons from all around the world, and which was what was the original aim of the society. It was actually to share techniques, you know, mm-hmm. and to share new surgical procedures. That was the original mission of the ISS. But new technology is expensive. So ISS cannot afford, okay, to support the new technology. What we can do is to bring the technology, you know, the companies to the
so that you can have a look at it and salivate. Yes. Can see but cannot touch.
See whether you can get the funding, you know.
Right, mm. Yeah.
Actually, buy the equipment.
Mm. We'll continue this conversation after another short break. Just we want to come back and find out a bit more about breast cancer surgery and research. I think another area that Prof. Yip not only super specializes in, but the research is also something she's very passionate about. We want to just look at how much the needle has moved and, you know, what does it mean for improving the lives of patients and survivors here in Malaysia. Together with my co-host, Dr. George Lee, we're speaking to Professor Emeritus Dato' Dr. Yip Ching Ha, Consultant Breast Surgeon and President of the International Society of Surgery. We'll be right back, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. Welcome back to Health and Living with me, T. Shaoik, and my co-host in the studio with me, Dr. George Lee, consultant urologist. We're speaking to our guest via Zoom today, Professor Emeritus Dato' Dr. Yip Ching Ha, consultant breast surgeon and president of the International Society of Surgery. Prof. Yip, a lot of your work has been specializing in breast surgery particularly, and research as well. You know, you are also the lead clinician for Cancer Research Malaysia right now. What has changed in terms of breast cancer research, impact on patients' outcomes since you began your work in this area?
Well, I started the breast unit in University of Malaya in 1993. That's many, many years ago. And when I started the unit, I also started a breast cancer database. And this is very important because now we have more than 10,000 breast cancer patients that is registered in this database. Even when I'm in private practice now, I still work with the university Malaya. We share our data. And I'm involved in quite a lot of the research projects that is being run by the University of Malaya as well. So from this database, we started small. I started writing papers on the small descriptive papers. And then we went, as our database got more and more mature, we went into looking at outcomes of breast cancer, looking at everything. You know, I look at the impact of ethnicity on breast cancer outcomes. And we have written a lot of this because this is called clinical epidemiology. Now, before I retired, I put in an application for a high-impact research grant. I was actually awarded a 17 million ringgit research grant over a five-year period. So that was the biggest research grant that I ever had. But it was very hard work because we had a lot of very tough KPIs to achieve, you know. I had to produce 120 high-impact research papers over 5 years. But I have a great team to work with because I divide my research into breast cancer genetics, into breast cancer clinical epidemiology, which is actually using the database to mine the data to look at all the outcome data. And we also we do the pathology, and we set up some research labs, you know, with money. So Even now, one of the labs is still running in the Department of Surgery because that was where we set up the lab. So that was how I started small. And then you just, as you get more and more publications, because before you get a research grant, people look at your track record. Mm. If you don't have a good track record, they're not going to give you money. So I think it's slowly 1993, right? Over 20 over years before I actually got a big break, you know, got big grants.
And and what do you want to achieve with that? You know, the grants and the kind of research you can
first
do.
First of all, I'm competitive. I just want to be the first to find out something, you know, be the first to write something on Malaysia. Because my research, we always look at breast cancer in low and middle income countries, because the advantage of Malaysia is that we have Malays, Chinese, Indians. These are all the main races in Asia. So we can't put like outcomes in Malaysian women because that's too small. You know, if you want to go into international publications, you've got to say that this is like a low and middle income country, or you say this is an Asian breast cancer, rather than be specific and say Malaysian breast cancer. Because when I started publishing, I asked one editor of a big journal, I said, why is it that I can't get this published? And then they say that, you know, this paper is so in just a small country. Basically, they say we are not interested in a small country in Malaysia, you know. Mm-hmm. So I think I learned through the years how to angle papers so that it would be interesting, because we need to publish in international peer-reviewed high-impact journals to be able to get to achieve our KPI. Yeah. Of course, now I'm in the private sector, I don't have to achieve KPIs anymore.
Your own KPI, that's probably be tougher. That's probably tougher than the one set for you. I mean, Prof, obviously it's 30 years next year since you started the breast unit in UH. And then what are the key findings that has changed the landscape of breast cancer in view of, you know, tomorrow is the first day of October and we're going into this Pink October. I'm sure we're hearing a lot more about breast cancer awareness. But what are your key findings in the last 30 years?
You must remember, it's a lot of teamwork. It's not just me alone. I have a great team, you know. Right now, back in UM, I have my successor, Prof. Aisha. I mean, her area is actually in qualitative research, looking at early detection, looking at why women present late. I mean, that is really very, very good. She's got a whole setup there looking at women. Okay, more qualitatively, why women do this, why women do that, and looking at patient support, women education. So one area that, and then I have another setup, clinical epidemiology, which is running well. This is Dr. Nirmala Bhupati. She's going to be professor one day soon, I think. And she looks at the clinical epidemiology. So she's looking at outcomes. Mm-hmm. This is based on the big data set that I started up. Now it is getting bigger and bigger. And she can do a lot of this high-tech epidemiology. You know, statistics has changed so much since we were young, isn't it, George?
That's right.
Now they do all sorts of fancy statistical analysis. So she has published a lot of papers on this. Another thing that we started when I was in university was this financial toxicity. You know, we started looking at this ASEAN cause of cancer thing that was in Southeast Asia. And from that, we got this publication, which is actually, you know, cited very often, because we want to get publications that are cited. Citations are what we want, you know. I mean, I can talk to you about age index and all that, but that's very...
But it was significant. The findings showed about financial catastrophe, right?
Yes, financial catastrophe in Malaysia due to cancer was 45%, despite having a universal health care. Mm-hmm. And Prof. Nirmala Bhupati has written all that. And of course, the jewel in our crown is the Cancer Research Malaysia under Prof. Teo Soo Huang. We have actually got the biggest, because at the same time, in 2003, when I started working with Cancer Research Malaysia, when they were set up, I collected blood. We've got now like 5,000-6,000 blood samples of cancer patients. And we've also got control. So can you imagine if you have blood, what a big research resource there. So we have data, we have blood. And when I went to SJMC, I also set up a tissue bank, you know, it was easier to set up tissue bank in a private hospital. And now we have like over 1,000 breast cancer tissue samples. This is actually a gold mine we are sitting on.
So what and kind of cancer, research questions do you want to find out more?
Well, Cancer Research Malaysia, their research is mainly in molecular genetics. So the research was very much into the BRCA, the mutations in the local population. And we published a lot on that. So we found out a lot about, you know, local population, how, what's the risk factor. And now they have developed this thing called ERICA, which we are testing, which is basically an Asian risk calculator. So we key in things like, you know, we have a patient with breast cancer. We can key in data like her tumor, you know, ER, PR, all the little pathological details. And we can come up with a percentage like your risk of having a BRCA mutation is 5%. So this is actually very useful for patients. Or if it's 22%, then they might want genetic testing before and counseling before testing. And then they would know the risk to their family, which is very important. But if they carry a mutation, their first degree relatives has a 50% chance of carrying a mutation.
I just feel like and George, you asked about awareness earlier for Pink October. I feel like, you know, with the kind of research that Prof Yip and her teams have done, we've gone beyond basic awareness, haven't
we? That's right. Well, but sadly, we still have many, many cancer patient sufferers presented late stages in Malaysia. And that's why awareness, no matter how much we've gone so far in research, we still have to get down to the basic.
And that was the one of the research projects that we did, like Prof. Aisha, who is my successor in UM, her MD thesis was actually on why women present late. So it's a qualitative study. So because you have to know why women present late before you can do intervention to get them to present early.
Yeah. Prof Yip, I'm sure we can talk all day about your research, but I'm quite keen to ask you a few things about post-COVID, you know, the landscape of access to healthcare. Early on, we talked about, you know, disparity in surgical access. Do you see any delay in diagnosis and also treatment following, obviously, all the lockdowns in COVID in your practice and also in public healthcare?
Well, it's definitely because of the COVID lockdown, patients were scared to come to hospital. So I was actually getting more advanced cases. And actually, I'm going to do a research on this. I've got somebody to do it for me. We are going to look at the year before COVID strike. There's the 2 years before COVID and 2 years during COVID. And we're going to look at the stage of diagnosis of breast cancer. And the little one that I did found that actually the stage was more advanced during the COVID period. And now after COVID, I have so many patients coming back. Of course, they think that COVID caused their breast cancer. They think vaccines caused their breast cancer, which is totally nonsense. So I keep assuring them that the number of cancer patients I see before COVID and after COVID is the same. Before the vaccine, after the vaccine is the same. So you cannot say that the vaccine caused your breast cancer, you know. And I have patients who actually did not come for their follow-ups during the COVID. I said we are open, but they are too, you know, the hospitals are all open, but they are all too scared to come, that's all. So I think we have to wait until the next 2 years before we know whether survival has been impacted. You know, because in private hospitals, the service has not been interrupted. We want patients to come. It's just that they don't want to come, isn't it, George? Because they're scared of coming to the hospital during COVID. But those two are cancers, like in the government hospitals, definitely they actually closed down elective surgery. But what happened was they had this private-public partnership. And even in even for me, you know, UM was sending their breast cancer patients to me for surgery because they cut down all their elective surgeries. So there was this thing going on, and the government hospital was sending to the private hospitals for surgery. So I think it was quite a very good initiative, you know, that was done. So I think right now, when everything is open, I don't think there's a big backlog anymore for cancer surgery anyway. Surgeries get done. Maybe the pure electives like the hernias and all these still have a backlog. Those sort of cases are not urgent. They can be done anytime, you know.
Oh, so I just want to read this message from a listener. I'm not sure who she is, but she said, "Congratulations, Prof. Yip. Best wishes from someone who taught you physiology when you were a bright young thing as a medical student."
I think I know who it is.
Wonderful. She does have a question though. She's asking, at what age does routine breast screenings become no longer necessary?
In US and in UK, it would be 74 years old. In UK, they stop screening at about 74.
How about
but here? I always say it's a physiological age. I have some 74s who look like 60. So I say, okay, you better continue screening because you've been doing it every 2 years. You know, it's every 2 year mammogram. I have a lot of patients who just come every 2 years for the mammogram, even when they're 80, because they just don't want to stop.
It's because they miss you.
No, it's because they can pay for it. I mean, if you're talking about the NHS, you know, then they would say that after 74, they don't see any benefit to screening.
But for women here in Malaysia, what can they take as a threshold?
Malaysia does not have a population screening program, so it's very much opportunistic.
But for a woman who's listening right now and, you know, she's been doing regular screenings, is there an age?
I would say don't stop as long as you feel you can go to the hospital. Of course, if you are having a heart attack or a stroke, then don't stop screening at that age because it's not going to be easy for you to come to hospital, because when you are like in your 70s, you're more likely to die of a heart attack than of breast cancer. That's why they say there's no point screening after 70, because the comorbidities like having diabetes, hypertension, all the other NCDs will be higher.
All right.
That's the chance of you dying from breast cancer.
But if you are able to do it, and if you can afford it, I suppose, no harm continuing.
If you are still fit, like if you are 80 and you look like 60, then go ahead.
Like you, Prof.
The issue is when to start screening. And that one has not actually been worked out yet, when to start screening. Because different countries have different ideas. Like in UK, they start screening at 50. In US, they actually advocated 40, but now they're advocating 45. In Malaysia, we were saying they start at 40, and then we said that's too young, mammogram cannot see them. We say start at 45, and then there was some we say start at 50. So the age of starting is more controversial than the age of stopping.
Well, on that note, though, do you have some very brief words of advice in conjunction with Pink October Month, which is coming up for breast cancer? A final takeaway for our listeners?
Well, I think the early detection gives you the best chance of cure from breast cancer. And early detection, mammogram is still the evidence-based method of early detection. Breast self-examination is still relevant, but studies have shown that it doesn't really improve survival. Now, clinical breast examination, when you go to a doctor who palpates your breast, some studies, like the Indian studies on CBE, shows that it may be as good as mammogram in early detection. Okay, so my message is that the best chance of cure from breast cancer comes from early detection. And October month, there are so many offers in all the different hospitals. You get free mammograms, subsidized mammograms. So this is the time.
Yep.
We have a lot of patients who wait until October to come for screening. So October is always very busy because we have all these tons of patients who come for screening.
All right. But I'm sure you welcome them anyway. And
that's
a great message. George?
Ching Ha, congratulations again. I have two take home from you. Number one is that always recognize yourself as a surgeon first before a woman. So I really think that is a great way to inspire the new generations of surgeons, full stop. Number two is that if you want to actually progress your way forward, choose your spouse, right?
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Professor Emeritus Dr. Yip Ching Ha, a consultant breast surgeon and president of the International Society of Surgery. Thanks to her husband as well for being so supportive. And my co-host, Dr. George Lee, consultant urologist. This has been Health and Living on BFM 89.9.
You have been listening to a podcast from BFM 89.9, the business station. For more stories of the same kind, download the BFM app.